Hello and welcome to the podcast where we dive into the fascinating world of education and everything that makes learning tick.
I'm excited for today's topic because it's one that's so central to education but often doesn't get the spotlight it deserves. We're talking about social and motivational factors in the classroom.
Absolutely. This is one of those areas where you realize just how much learning is shaped by the social environment around it. It's not just about textbooks and quizzes. It's about relationships, identity, and how those things influence motivation. So, Lisa, where do we start?
Let's start by illustrating just how intertwined relationships and learning are. Picture this, a middle school classroom with all kinds of activity going on. You've got a teacher kneeling next to a shy student, helping them with a simple task, while nearby a small group works on a jigsaw puzzle with defined roles and sticker note reflections. And then there's a student seeking attention, but instead of being disruptive, they're calmly redirected by a peer with a little teacher guidance. What does that scene say to you, James?
It tells me that the classroom isn't just an academic space, it's a social ecosystem. You've got relationships being built, collaborative problem-solving happening, and even subtle peer-to-peer coaching. And what really strikes me is how all these interactions are anchored by visible tools, like a growth mindset poster or a help chain board. It's clear that the environment is designed to support relationships and motivation.
Exactly. That's what today's discussion is about, how the social world of the classroom and a learner's identity interact to create, or sometimes block, motivation and real learning. And the research backs this up. Learning doesn't happen in isolation. It's deeply social. Peers, teachers, even family, shape things like attention, curiosity, and persistence.
So, in a sense, motivation sits right in the middle of all this. Strong, safe interactions can boost self-esteem, which then leads to more intrinsic motivation, and that, in turn, drives better learning outcomes. But Lisa, where does the teacher fit into all of this?
The teacher's role is absolutely crucial. By shaping the quality of interactions and fostering a sense of community, teachers can significantly increase the chances that students will activate themselves as learners. There's actually a clear chain here. Teacher-student interaction leads to better self-esteem, which then boosts motivation, and that motivation drives learning and, ultimately, school success.
Right. And not all interactions are created equal. Research categorizes these into three broad groups. You've got safe and secure interactions, which are about 20 to 30% of students. These kids trust themselves and are socially confident. They're easy to engage. Then there's the unstable or seeking group, which makes up the largest portion, around 40 to 60%. They test relationships first and need attention before they'll fully engage. And finally, there's the rejected or avoidant group, roughly 10 to 20%, who tend to withdraw or resist unless their relational needs are addressed.
And that's why improving teacher-student interaction, even just a little, can have such a big impact. A small improvement in interaction quality can raise a student's self-esteem, which makes it easier to build intrinsic motivation. And what's fascinating is that good interaction can motivate a student even if their self-esteem is still developing. So both pathways, self-esteem and direct engagement, are important.
That's such an important point. And speaking of relationships, let's talk about peers and group dynamics, because classrooms aren't just one-on-one spaces. Social constructivism, particularly Vygotsky's work, shows us that we often learn best through social interaction. Peers and more knowledgeable others help us reach beyond what we can do alone, what he called the zone of proximal development.
Exactly. And group learning isn't just about academic outcomes, it also builds reasoning, moral judgment, and reflection. For example, when students reflect in groups, they often deepen their understanding in a way that solitary reflection can't achieve. Plus, being part of a group helps shape identity. Shared values, a sense of belonging, and cooperative norms all play a huge role in motivation and behavior.
So, what makes for healthy group work? I know Thomas Licona has some great guidance on this.
He does. It starts with helping students know each other as individuals. Things like name routines or quick personal sharing sessions can make a big difference. Then you want to build a culture of care and support, with structured peer help and rotating roles. And finally, The group should have shared values and goals, which you can reinforce by co-creating class norms and making commitments visible in the classroom.
And there are some really practical strategies to make this happen, right? For instance, structured peer tutoring, where you mix confident students with those who need more support. Or cooperative tasks like jigsaw activities, where each student has a specific role. You could even hold group reflection circles after an activity to discuss what they learned, who helped, and what they'll improve next time.
Absolutely. And this ties directly into identity and self-concept. A student's self-concept can be global, like a general belief in their capability, or domain-specific, like feeling confident in art but anxious in maths. Teachers play a key role here, especially with feedback and grading, because those directly impact self-esteem. For example, lower-than-expected grades can sometimes be internalized as "I'm not good enough," which can hurt motivation.
That's so true. And there are also gender and identity patterns to consider. Research shows that boys' outcomes, for instance, can be more sensitive to teacher approval and subject choices that align with their interests. But when teacher-student interactions are safe and supportive, boys' performance can equal or even surpass girls. It really underscores that social factors matter more than innate ability.
So what can teachers do about identity? Well, they can build subject-specific competence experiences. Start with small successes to anchor future learning. They can also use growth-oriented language that emphasizes progress and strategies over fixed abilities. And offering varied task types, like visual, hands-on, or verbal tasks, gives different learners a chance to shine.
I love that, and it leads us perfectly into the topic of motivation. Let's talk about intrinsic vs. extrinsic motivation. Intrinsic motivation, things like curiosity and internal satisfaction, leads to deeper and more lasting learning. But extrinsic rewards, like prizes or grades, can be tricky. They might motivate in the short term, but they often do so for the reward itself, not for the learning.
Right, and extrinsic rewards can even backfire if they undermine intrinsic motivation. For example, if you promise a reward for a task, it can make the task feel less meaningful. But unexpected rewards, like surprise praise or an unplanned token, tend to be less harmful. And with grades, it's a double-edged sword. They can motivate insecure students, but they can also feel punitive and hurt self-esteem if not handled carefully.
So the key is to design tasks that are inherently engaging. Novelty, relevance, challenge, and usefulness all boost intrinsic motivation. And giving students autonomy or meaningful choices lets them feel ownership of their learning. Emphasizing mastery goals, like improving or understanding, over performance goals, like getting the highest grade, can also make a big difference.
Exactly. And as we wrap up, let's touch on some practical classroom practices. Things teachers can do before, during, and after teaching to foster motivation and relationships. Before teaching, it's important to learn about students' backgrounds and check prior knowledge. Co-creating class norms is another great way to build a sense of community.
During teaching, starting with a social hook is key, something like a quick check-in or a group discussion starter. Mixing social and cognitive tasks, like pair work or role plays, helps keep students engaged. And don't forget reflection cycles. Kolb's model of experience, reflection, conceptualization, and application works wonders for deep learning.
After teaching, it's all about feedback. Provide formative feedback that's timely and constructive, and give students chances to revise their work. Publicly recognize progress in specific ways, like commenting on a strategy they used. And plan follow-up tasks that consolidate both skills and a sense of belonging, like peer presentations or collaborative portfolios.
This has been such a rich discussion, Lisa. I feel like we've covered everything from the social foundations of learning to practical strategies teachers can use right away. Any final thoughts?
Just that relationships and motivation are at the heart of effective teaching. If we get those right, the academic outcomes will follow. It's all about creating a classroom environment where every student feels seen, supported, and inspired to learn.
Well said. Thanks for joining us today, everyone.
Bye for now, and happy teaching.